Although they contained information that had not been released, someone who'd seen the crime scenes would have been able to write them. Stiltz publicly asked the unsub to send another letter with even more details that only the killer would know. His challenge worked, yielding not only a letter, but an identity of sorts. The elusive subject gave himself a name that would soon become synonymous with terror in the Northern California region, the Zodiac. Despite the allure and sexiness of this appellation, the unsub never really explained why or how he'd chosen it. One would expect some sort of mystical, astrological connection. In none of the subject's future communications was this convincing, although Robert Graysmith uncovered a Zodiac alphabet dating back to the 13th century. The 20th century Zodiac may have copied and or modified some of the symbols in that alphabet to use in his coded message. The 3-page letter was sent to the Vallejo Times-Herald just days after Stiltz's request. It began, "Dear Editor, this is the Zodiac speaking. In answer to your asking for more details about the good times I have had in Vallejo, I shall be very happy to supply even more material. By the way, are the police having a good time with the code?" The whimsical, quasi-helpful tone of the opening of the letter underscores the unsub's delight in mocking the police. Many people likened the Zodiac's taunting letters to Jack the Ripper's Dear Boss communications, though as noted in Chapter 1, I believe the Ripper notes to have been fakes. Still, we can't rule out the possibility that the unsub was taking his lead from the popular image of the Whitechapel killer. Remember, this guy alluded to a classic short story in his cryptogram. Studying the Ripper murders would be even more right up his alley, so to speak. At any rate, he felt superior to the police and press, just as the actual author of the Dear Boss letters wanted us to think of the East End murderer. The Zodiac went on to provide explicit, moment-by-moment details of the murder of Darlene Farren and the attempted murder of Michael Mageau. Certainly, descriptions such as the following would prove to Chief Stiltz that the author and the killer were one and the same. On the 4th of July, the boy was originally sitting in the front seat when I began firing. When I fired the first shot at his head, he leaped backwards at the same time, thus spoiling my aim. He ended up on the back seat, then the floor in back, thrashing out very violent with his legs. That's how I shot him in the knee. He even described the witness who saw him in the phone booth after the murders, having some fun with the Vallejo cop, thus proving he was also the one who placed at least that call. The Zodiac also included an extensive section on the Jensen Faraday murders. Last Christmas, in that episode, the police were wondering as to how I could shoot and hit my victims in the dark. They did not openly state this, but implied this by saying it was a well-lit night and I could see silhouettes on the horizon. Bullshit. That area is surrounded by high hills and trees. What I did was tape a small pencil flashlight to the barrel of my gun. When taped to a gun barrel, the bullet will strike exactly in the center of the black dot in the light. All I had to do was spray them. With this, the subject provided proof not only that he was on the scene the night Jensen and Faraday were killed, but that he actively followed his own press. You can see why I say the way facts are presented has an impact on the offender. In this case, the Zodiac had obviously been peeved for months by how the police made it seem that striking his targets that night was easier than it had been. This perception would fuel his general frustration at being misunderstood, that his skills were underappreciated, and his sense of inferiority. He had to make sure the planning, thought, and marksmanship that went into the crime would be fully appreciated. Thus, so many months later, he felt the need to include this information in a letter sent to answer questions about the more recent murders. Again, this speaks to the subject's self-conscious compulsiveness. It also tells us that in conversations with others, he may have been complaining about the police and press coverage of the earlier killings. In the days after the Christmastime murders, I can imagine him grousing to a crony, another loner, less intelligent than he and one of his few confidants, that the police didn't know what they were talking about. Look how dark it was that night, for example. Lake Berryessa. Saturday, September 27th, 1969, was a sunny, warm day. A day to be spent out of doors. And if you knew where to hunt, it was a perfect day for a killer to find new targets. 35 miles north of Vallejo, Lake Berryessa Park was just such a location, with woods and secluded beaches around a man-made lake more than 25 miles long. Cecilia Ann Shepherd, 22, was spending time with a friend of hers from Pacific Union College, 20-year-old Brian Hartnell, before she went off to continue her studies in music at the University of California, Riverside. After a morning of worship and packing, they spent the afternoon seeing friends and running errands around the Napa Valley wine country before stopping by the park in late afternoon. It was just after 4 p.m. when they walked out onto a peninsula on the western side of the lake and put down a blanket. Every so often a boat would pass by, but for the most part, they were completely alone. At some point, Cecilia noticed a man approaching them. Because of the topography and foliage, he would disappear from view behind a slope in the hill or a tree, only to reappear much closer. When he was finally in front of them, the couple realized he had a gun. He had also put on a bizarre, elaborate costume with a hooded mask and a symbol sewn onto his chest. The mask resembled a paper grocery bag in shape, flat on top, with the corners standing out. It was black, with slits cut for eyes and mouth. Over the eye holes, the mysterious man wore clip-on sunglasses. The mask draped down over his chest and back, with a symbol sewn onto it, a circle with a cross, like the crosshairs of a gun sight. The hood was worn over a dark-colored windbreaker, and this in turn over a rusty black shirt. His sleeves were tied around his wrists, and he wore black gloves. Under the costume, he had on baggy pleated pants, tucked into boots. He wore a belt with a wooden holder for a long knife. The knife resembled a bayonet and had a wooden handle with brass rivets wrapped up in surgical tape. One of his victims would later describe the man as 5'10" to 6'2", 225 to 250 pounds, stocky in build. At one point, a glimpse into the space behind his sunglasses revealed brown hair and a glimmer, suggesting he might have worn glasses under the hood. When he spoke, he sounded in his 20s. He demanded the couple's money and car keys, explaining that he wanted the car to drive to Mexico. When Brian handed over his money and keys to his VW Carmen Ghia, the man holstered his gun. He explained that he'd escaped from prison in Deer Lodge, Montana, where he'd killed a prison guard. He said he had no money and was driving a stolen car, and warned Brian not to try to be a hero. For his part, the pre-law student was trying to keep the man calm, offering to help him any way he could. But the man pulled out some clothesline and ordered Cecilia to tie up Brian. As she did, she pulled his wallet out of his pocket and tossed it to the man. He seemed to ignore this gesture and bound her when she'd finished with Brian. Then he double-checked her work, retying Brian's knots when he decided they were too loose. He announced he was going to stab them, and Brian requested he be the first victim, arguing he couldn't bear to see the man stab Cecilia. The assailant complied, stabbing him repeatedly in the back. He then turned his attention to the girl who'd been screaming at him to stop. As she squirmed to get away, he stabbed her over and over, hitting her in the back, chest, abdomen, and groin. When he was done, the attacker left the money and keys on the blanket and simply walked off. His victims were still alive, and although Cecilia was mortally wounded, stabbed 24 times and her aorta slashed, the two were able to untie each other's bindings. But they'd lost so much blood, neither was in any shape to go for help. A fisherman and his son passing by rushed to contact park rangers from Rancho Monticello Resort 2 miles from the scene. Ranger Dennis Land responded by patrol car, finding Brian several hundred yards from the scene as far as he could crawl. Ranger Sergeant William White covered the distance by boat. There was no ambulance at Lake Berryessa, and the nearest medical help was nearly an hour away in Napa at Queen of the Valley Hospital. Although both survived the long, painful wait, Cecilia eventually succumbed to her injuries and died in the hospital the next afternoon. Brian was placed under constant guard. At around 7:40 p.m., a little more than an hour after the attack, as the couple were still awaiting the ambulance, a call came into the Napa County Police Department. The officer on duty listened as the male caller reported a double murder at the park, giving a description of the victim's car and their location. The caller sounded young, maybe early 20s. In a quiet voice, he ended the call by announcing he was the killer. When he finished talking, he simply left the phone off the hook, and the officer could hear sounds of traffic, people talking in the background. The call was traced to a payphone at a car wash less than 5 miles from the police station, 27 miles from the crime scene. Did the caller drive that far because he liked the feeling of being close to the police without them realizing who he was? Was it on his way home, or both? Based on the timing of the phone call and that the caller said the victims were dead, police figured he must have left Lake Berryessa immediately after the attack. A palm print was pulled off the phone receiver, but there was nothing to compare it to. A lone man was reported hanging around the lake that day. Three female students from Pacific Union College told police that a man in a car described as a light blue or silver Chevy, California tags, seemed to be watching them that afternoon. When they parked, he parked next to them and just sat in his car, smoking cigarettes. This was shortly before 3 p.m. About 4, they were sunbathing at the lake when they spotted the same guy looking at them. They described him as tall, 6 feet or more, 200 to 230 pounds, mid-20s to mid-30s, with straight dark hair worn with a side part. They thought he looked clean-cut, wearing a black sweatshirt with short sleeves and dark blue slacks, although he had a t-shirt hanging out of his pants in the back. The girls worked with a police sketch artist to develop a composite. Police released the drawing, but Napa Sheriff's Captain Don Townsend stressed that this was not necessarily a sketch of the suspect, but of someone police would like to interview. A man matching the girl's description was also seen by a dentist out with his son. He estimated the man to be about 5'10", stocky, wearing a dark long-sleeved shirt with some red and dark pants. When the man realized he'd been spotted, he left, and when the dentist and his son returned to their car, they could tell from tire tracks that a car had been parked right behind theirs. Near Brian's car, investigators found tire tracks and made plaster cases in hopes they'd soon have a suspect vehicle for comparison. They measured the distance between the tires and noted that the front of the car seemed to have tires that were not only worn, but of two different sizes. Footprints led to the crime scene and back and to the door of the Carmen Ghia. The shoe size was 10.5, and based on how deep the prints went into the sand, compared to prints left by a police officer, the subject was estimated to weigh at least 220 pounds. And he was a cool customer. The heels of the man's prints were clearly defined, which told police he wasn't running but walking away as he left his victims to die. The prints also had an identifying mark, which investigators were able to trace to the manufacturer. They were from a wing walker, a type of boot produced under government contract and distributed on the West Coast to Navy and Air Force installations. This was but one indication that law enforcement was looking for a subject with a military background. He was obviously familiar with weapons, was an excellent shot, was not afraid to kill up close and personal with a knife, and had at least been exposed to symbols used by the military and had possibly been trained in codes. He had been described as clean-cut, with short hair, and certainly Northern California had no lack of military installations. I would have advised police to look into medical discharges, or discharges with no reason given, because the subject probably couldn't cut it in such a structured, disciplined environment long-term. He would be highly intelligent and skillful, but would have trouble with authority and resent the intrusions of others. The unsub had also given another clue to his identity by his reference to Deer Lodge, Montana. There is and was a prison there, and while the story of his breakout and murder of a guard proved false, connections to that place should not have been ruled out. For one thing, you don't just pull a location like Deer Lodge, Montana out of a hat. I spent some time as a student at Montana State in Bozeman, and I didn't recognize the name, so I can assure you that most people outside of Big Sky Country wouldn't have heard of the place. This guy fully expected both Cecilia and Brian would end up dead. In fact, when he misspoke in his call to police to report the crime as a murder, he corrected himself to clarify it was actually a double murder. If both victims were to die, there'd be no risk in mentioning a place that held some significance to him. I think this information can be used to law enforcement's advantage. Here's a scenario. Cooperate with an investigative reporter writing about the cases locally in Deer Lodge. With the facts of the murders, release general profile information on the suspect, indicating that police in California have reason to believe the killer has links to the area, without leaking why they believe this. Along with the elements garnered from witnesses, white male, mid-20s to early 30s, etc., the profile would include the following behavioral traits. Suspect is a loner, paranoid, nocturnal, and intelligent. He has an extreme interest in weapons, and may have left the area for military reasons if, for example, he was to be stationed in California, and he may have had a medical discharge from the military since then. He may also have communicated with someone in Deer Lodge in a position of authority in a scornful way, as a precursor to his taunting letters to police and the press in California. A little later, we'll get into a more detailed discussion of proactive techniques I'd try in this case, but I have to stress now that this is the type of investigation where that approach is most helpful. The offender is communicating with the police and the newspapers, so you know he's following his press. This makes him vulnerable, because he can't help but react to what is said and printed about him. Look how quickly he responded to Chief Stilts, for example. On the other side of the coin, he's a white male, paranoid loner who likes guns and isn't real successful with women. A lot of social misfits out there meet that general description. In this case, then, profiling is only going to be so helpful in narrowing the field of suspects. You have to flush this guy out, do something to make him come forward. I think in large part this is why the Zodiac was never apprehended. In the late 60s and early 70s, he was a modern serial killer being pursued by old-fashioned, tried-and-true investigative techniques. He slaughtered people who were either unknown to him or could not be traced back to him. His motives were non-traditional and undecipherable. He evolved, using different MOs and different weapons at each crime scene. He moved from one jurisdiction to another, manipulating public and press everywhere he went. Like the Jensen-Faraday case, the Berryessa attacks occurred on a site with overlapping jurisdictions. So while park rangers rushed to the scene and stayed with the victims, the Napa County Sheriff's Office spearheaded the investigation. Detective Sergeant Kenneth Narlow arrived to find someone had already cleaned up the crime scene, packing away for him the couple's blanket and the clothesline used to tie them. We've made the case in other chapters, too, that the more people you have working a crime scene, the more confusing it is for the people who end up with ultimate responsibility for the case. One aspect of the scene, however, was completely undisturbed, although highly disturbing to Narlow. Before he'd left, the unsub left a message on the door of Brian Hartnell's car in black marker. Vallejo, 12-20-68, 7-4-69, September 27-69-6:30, by knife. The first two dates mark the murders of Jensen Faraday and Farron. Above the words appear the crossed circle symbol the Zodiac used as his signature in the letters mailed to the press in early August. This unsub wanted to make sure the police realized they were dealing with a serial killer. At first glance, it might seem obvious that these attacks were related. After all, we're dealing with a subject who targets young couples in remote areas at night or evening, and for whom typical motives such as robbery or sexual assault do not apply. But there are critical differences between this case and the others, and I don't mean just the bizarre, apparently homemade costume. Without his hint, given the change in jurisdiction and location, investigators might not have immediately linked this case to the ones in Vallejo. In a sense, the subject was almost giving police a break by telling them to look for one offender. Back at Quantico, my unit saw many cases of linkage blindness. That is, a serial offender would change and perfect his M.O., move to other jurisdictions, or escalate in violence as a typical progression, so police would think several criminals were at work when it was really all done by the same one. Here's an example. A rapist murderer starts out assaulting and strangling a prostitute, leaving her body in the alley where the crime took place. He realizes afterward that next time, it'll be less risky if he transports his victim to another location where he won't face the danger of someone walking in on him. So he picks up his next victim and takes her out to a remote site and leaves her body there. And since he has more time with her, he doesn't have to rape and kill her as quickly, so maybe this time he'll torture her a little. With practice, this same guy could be picking up lonely, vulnerable women in bars, holding them for a few days of torture before killing them, and disposing of their bodies in places where they might never be found. Without behavioral or forensic clues to link the crimes, especially if they're committed in different jurisdictions, so investigators in one place never hear about the others, police might never make the connection. And my example isn't such a stretch. I testified as an expert witness to help secure the conviction of serial murderer George Russell Jr., where the linkage was based on the signature element of posing. Now, let's consider the differences between the Lake Berryessa attack and the previous ones in Vallejo. First, there's a big difference between shooting at people in a car and stabbing them. In the first case, you get away clean. You're watching it unfold before you, but you're not really coming in contact with your victims. And at Lake Berryessa, we're talking about spending time talking to the victims, hearing their voices, developing something of a rapport with them. Then, after the subject gets what he is ostensibly after, the victims freely complied with his demands for their money and car keys, remember, he brutally attacks anyway. With each thrust of his knife, he was getting more and more of their blood on him, hearing them screaming and moaning in pain. Remember, too, that he had a gun with him, meaning he didn't have to use his knife. If it was fear or control he was after, he could have used the knife and his words effectively for that, resorting to the gun when it came time to finish them off. He chose to use the knife. And since it was dusk rather than midnight, he got a good look at the horrible scene before him. This brings us to the next point. The earlier timing and location of the attack indicates the subject's willingness to take greater risks. It was mid-afternoon when the three college students and the dentist and his son spotted the suspicious man. The self-styled killing uniform Brian Hartnell described was good for hiding the killer's face and hair, but would only have attracted attention if he had tried to wear it the whole time he was in the park. Although no one was likely to stumble upon the scene as the killer stabbed Brian and Cecilia, it was possible. And although a knife makes no noise compared to a gunshot, the victim's screams could certainly attract attention. If someone had seen them from a boat, the unsub had no way to keep them from reporting the attack. The best he'd be able to do would be to beat a hasty retreat, possibly leaving several witnesses able to give police a description. He furthered his risks by spending so much time talking to the victims, and murder by stabbing takes longer than a couple of quick gunshots. There was also the disturbing trend of the shortening time between the murders. 7 months had passed between the Jensen Faraday murders and the assault on Darlene Farron and Michael Mageau. The Lake Berryessa attack came less than 3 months later. In all aspects, then, this crime clearly represented a progression from the other murders. Successful offenders such as this don't just stop committing crimes, and as they continue, they only get bolder and, typically, more violent and deadly. One could only expect the Zodiac to continue on this course. Taxi driver. It was 9:30 p.m., October 11th, when cab driver Paul Lee Stein picked up a fare on Geary Street in San Francisco. Stein was already answering a call from a fare on 9th Avenue, but was stuck in the crush of people milling about the theater district on a foggy Saturday night. When the lone man approached his cab for a ride, he requested a location that was on the way to the 9th Avenue call, so Stein picked him up. He wrote the destination, Washington and Maple, in his log, and headed west toward the residential area near the Presidio. Although Stein's trip sheet said Washington and Maple, the cab eventually stopped one block farther at Washington and Cherry. At this location, instead of paying his fare and exiting the cab, the rider shot Paul Stein in the right side of his face at close range. He then moved into the front seat and took the cabbie's wallet. He also ripped off part of Stein's shirt. He left Stein's Timex watch, checkbook, a ring, and a little over $4 in change in the cab driver's pocket. When he was done, he got out of the cab and wiped down sections of the driver's door and the left rear passenger door. He then leaned against the divider between the front and back windows of the car as he opened the driver's door and wiped off the dashboard before he closed the door and walked off into the night. What he didn't know was that virtually the entire event had been witnessed by a 14-year-old girl at a party just across the street. She was looking out a second-story window about 50 feet from the cab. When she realized what she was seeing, she summoned her two brothers to the window. By the time the stocky white man was wiping down the cab, a crowd of people were gathered around with a clear view out the window. They didn't stop watching until he disappeared from their view, turning the corner. He simply walked from the scene. While this was unfolding, people at the party called the police. At 9:58 p.m., the operator taking details of the crime in progress somehow ended up describing the suspect as a black man. So when the dispatcher put out the all-points bulletin, units on the street were given the proper direction the suspect was headed, but an incorrect physical description. What happened next has been subject to different interpretations. By several accounts, including the Zodiacs given in a later letter, the first officers responding to the call in a patrol car got to the intersection of Cherry Street and Jackson within minutes and saw a stocky white man walking in the direction of the Presidio. Had there been more light, they might have seen blood on his dark clothing. And had they known the unsub was white, this story might have gone in any of a number of different directions. But since they were looking for a black man, they just asked him if he'd seen anything suspicious. He reported seeing a man with a gun running along Washington Street, heading east. So off they went. The patrolman realized about a week later that they'd likely seen the killer, and worked with an artist to develop a composite sketch. When Robert Graysmith researched this miscommunication, he found their report had been filed away as confidential, and the official statement from the San Francisco police was that none of their officers had ever seen the suspect. But that position does not explain the existence of the composite sketch, which was actually the second one prepared, since a police artist drew one the morning after the murder with input from the witnesses at the party. This near miss could have afforded a great opportunity, unrecognized at the time, to get the Zodiac to come forward. A statement could have been released stating that the police were seeking assistance from the community following this heinous crime. The announcement would make it clear that several people other than the suspect had been seen in the area at the time and were now being identified. Police would like to speak with anyone who was there to see if they'd seen anything. If it worked, the subject would come forward with a story that would legitimately place him in the area and cover his butt in case anyone else had seen him. When they arrived, police found Paul Stein slumped over onto the passenger side of the front seat, with his head on the floor of the cab. There was much blood, and although the keys were missing, the meter, eerily, was still running. In addition to the first two officers who responded, Inspector Walter Crack, a homicide detective on his way home, heard the call and got quickly to the crime scene. His experience would prove valuable as he helped the other officers secure the scene. By the time homicide inspectors Dave Toskey and partner Bill Armstrong, the team on duty that night, got there, the ambulance had already arrived and Stein been declared dead. Crack had notified the coroner and requested all available canine units and a spotlight vehicle from the fire department to assist in the search. While investigators worked the scene, the search fanned out using dogs, patrolmen on foot, and military police from the nearby base. The Presidio was just a couple of blocks from where the murder took place, and neighbors told police they'd seen a person matching the general description of the unsub rushing across a nearby playground and into the wooded base. For the next few hours, it must have seemed almost daylight as floodlights and flashlights illuminated the area. The search was called off at 2 a.m., about 4 hours after Stein was declared dead from a gunshot wound to the brain. A badly damaged, copper-covered bullet from a 9mm was recovered at autopsy. The killer had fired only the one shot from his semi-automatic pistol. It was an uncommon type. Under 150 were sold in the entire Bay Area over the previous 3 years. Damage to the skin of Stein's right cheek indicated the gun had been held right up to his head. Defense wounds were on the cab driver's left hand. Looking at the victimology, Paul Stein, 29, was married and working toward a doctorate in English from San Francisco State College. To pay for school, in addition to driving the cab at night, he worked as an insurance salesman. At 5'9" and 180 pounds, he wasn't a small man. In his personal life, with his interests, nothing would have labeled him a possible victim of violent crime, except that cab drivers are high-risk victims by profession. Their job calls for them to pick up strangers and take them wherever they want to go at all hours of the day and night. Because they carry cash, they are frequent targets of robberies, and worse. Not even 2 weeks before Stein's murder, another driver from his cab company was robbed, and just over a month earlier, Stein himself had been held up by two gunmen. Indeed, at first, this looked like a botched robbery committed by a criminally unsophisticated subject. The offender would have fled with blood all over him, and he left valuables behind. When police reconstructed Stein's earlier fares, they estimated the most the killer could have walked away with was about $25. On top of that, he left evidence. On the side of the car where the unsub rested his right hand to balance as he reached in to wipe off the dash, he'd left two fingerprints in blood. And then there were the witnesses. The kids at the party described Paul Stein's killer as white, in his mid-20s to 30 years of age, with reddish-blonde hair cut short, like a crew cut. He wore glasses and dark-colored pants and a parka. He was stocky, maybe 5'8". The description and the composite sketch were circulated among cab companies throughout San Francisco, warning of the killer's M.O. Almost as quickly as the police bulletin made its rounds, a development in the case proved Stein's murder was more than the standard cab robbery gone bad. In October, the San Francisco Chronicle received a letter on which the return address was simply a symbol, a circle with extended crosshairs. It began as another had before it. "This is the Zodiac speaking." The author claimed credit for Stein's murder and offered graphic evidence as proof, actually enclosing a piece of the victim's bloody shirt. Then he referenced the people in the North Bay area, taking credit for them as well. The lab confirmed that the swatch was from the cab driver's shirt, and when Toski and Armstrong met with Detective Sergeant Narlow in Napa, he thought the handwriting matched their guy's, a finding later confirmed by Sherwood Morrill, head of California's Questioned Documents Department in Sacramento. The police were getting no credit for their hard work from the Zodiac, however. In this latest letter, he mocked their efforts to find him following Stein's murder. "The SF police could have caught me last night if they had searched the park properly, instead of holding road races with their motorcycles to see who could make the most noise. The car drivers should have just parked their cars and sat there quietly waiting for me to come out of cover." His message seemed to have an effect. San Francisco's Chief of Inspectors Marty Lee put up a brave face before the press, saying that if the Zodiac had really been just outside police grasp that night, he would have mentioned the dogs and the floodlights used in the search. I suggest that if the killer had been the man the patrolman spoke to, that would explain the level of scorn here. He almost got caught, and he got scared, but he couldn't admit that to law enforcement or himself, so he had to get cocky. We expect an offender like this to overcompensate for his feelings of inferiority by putting down those he actually secretly envies. He got lucky, but he had to perceive that he had outsmarted the police. Another way for this type to prove his superiority is to once again find a way to get more control, more power. This one accomplished that by closing his letter with a terrifying threat. "School children make nice targets. I think I shall wipe out a school bus some morning. Just shoot out the front tire, and then pick off the kiddies as they come bouncing out. In cooperation with SFPD, the Chronicle did not release news of this threat for several days. After having released other portions of the letter and the composite sketch, this resulted only in a slight delay of the ensuing panic. Throughout San Francisco, Napa, and surrounding jurisdictions, steps were taken to protect schoolchildren. Extra drivers were assigned to buses to watch for trouble and to take over in case a driver was shot. In some cases, armed police guards were on the buses. Pickup trucks from the Forestry Department and ranger stations at Lake Berryessa were put into service. Airplanes even monitored bus routes from the sky. You have to be careful with a threat like this. Obviously, this guy is capable of killing people, and you have to take precautions. But I find the actual threat more designed to, once again, put the fear of God in the community and manipulate public emotions. If the Lake Berryessa and San Francisco attacks were high risk, you really couldn't get much riskier than shooting at a bus full of kids in broad daylight. From the offender's point of view, this would be almost a suicide mission. But all the police activity generated by this threat becomes the ideal face-saving scenario. He would have carried out his threat, but the heat was just too great. Some attempts were made to proactively reach the Zodiac via the media. California Attorney General Thomas Lynch issued a formal statement in which he assured the killer he would receive help and his legal rights would be fully protected if he turned himself in. Lynch tried to appeal to the Zodiac's vanity, saying that as an intelligent individual, the killer realized he would eventually be caught and would recognize surrender as the best course. The Examiner also tried, but neither approach brought the killer to the police. In another approach, Dr. D.C. B. Marsh, who headed the American Cryptogram Association, issued a challenge to the killer. Using the Zodiac's own code, Marsh composed a message providing a phone number for the Zodiac to call when he had a coded message that did actually contain his identity. Dr. Marsh's challenge, published in the San Francisco Examiner, went unanswered. Despite this, I would still consider it a great idea, and the type of technique I advise, as it was tailored to the personality of the unsub. Less than 2 weeks after the Stein murder, a major meeting was convened at the San Francisco Hall of Justice. Investigators from Vallejo, Napa, Benicia, Solano, San Mateo, and Marin met with representatives of the FBI, the State Bureau of Criminal Identification and Investigation, Naval Intelligence, the California Highway Patrol, U.S. Postal Inspectors, anyone who had a hand in the case. The seminar covered each crime known to be linked thus far, and a comparison of all the evidence available. If I'd been involved, along with interjurisdictional cooperation, I would have been stressing the need to be proactive. Ironically, one approach I counsel police to try in cases like this was initiated, but by the offender. I can imagine the Zodiac in late October 1969, seeing that the news programs and papers were devoting less and less coverage to the school bus threat, wondering how in the hell to top that. While I would not necessarily have been able to predict exactly what shape it would take, I would have been able to tell you that the unsub was going to need to do something to get himself back in the limelight. He was probably still reeling from his close call after he killed Stein, although he wouldn't have admitted it. So he wasn't ready for another murder. And since he hadn't carried out his last written threat, he probably sensed that anything he put in another letter would have muted impact. What he needed was a publicity stunt. Now, one technique I used to recommend was to identify someone in the public eye as a sympathetic character. We know most subjects follow their own press, so depending on the dynamics of the case and the type of offender, I'd advise police to establish someone the offender would feel comfortable contacting in some way. So, for example, at the same time that a local law enforcement bigwig was branding the unsubbed a crazed maniac, you could offer newspaper reporters access to a leading psychiatrist whose message would be 180 degrees in opposition. This man isn't crazy. In fact, he is highly intelligent, which is why the police haven't caught him. But he is misunderstood. You could photograph the shrink at his office, conveniently mentioning where the office is located and making sure the number and address are in the book. Then you sit back and hope the unsub makes contact with the one person he sees as capable of understanding his message, of serving as his voice to correct misperceptions. What the Zodiac did was bypass the setup. At 2 a.m., a call came into the Oakland Police Department across the bay from San Francisco. The caller identified himself as the Zodiac and requested a phone conversation with the high-profile criminal attorney F. Lee Bailey, or, if he was unavailable, famed local attorney Melvin Belli. The caller said he wanted one of these two to appear on a local morning talk show. I find the Zodiac's choices interesting. F. Lee Bailey had a reputation as a master of acquittal, after successfully defending all but three of the more than 100 killers he had represented. And Belli had made headlines by defending infamous characters such as Jack Ruby and Mickey Cohen. As the years since then have proved, both attorneys had a flair for attracting media attention, and clearly, this was what the Zodiac sought. As it turned out, first choice Bailey couldn't make it, but Belli appeared that morning on Channel 7, next to host Jim Dunbar. They began the show one half-hour earlier than normal. As they anxiously waited and viewers watched, the first of many calls came in a little after 7 a.m. The caller kept hanging up and calling back, identifying himself as Sam, and giving Belli and Dunbar details of his headaches and loneliness. A dozen of the 35 phone calls were actually broadcast, and a meeting was arranged. Belli led a parade of police and media to the appointed spot at 10:30 that morning. You can probably guess the rest. Sam never showed. Later phone calls to Belli from this caller were eventually traced to a mental patient at Napa State Hospital. The police officer who had answered the phone when the call first came into the Oakland PD thought the caller to the TV show sounded different from the one he had talked to. But it really didn't matter who called Belli that morning as far as the Zodiac was concerned. He'd gotten his press, live. He'd succeeded in manipulating everyone in the viewing area, had a whole region on the edge of its seat, and had a famous personality at his beck and call with just a few hours' notice. On top of that, precautions were still being taken to make sure he didn't take out a school bus. And police were no closer to identifying him. He still had to keep his hand in, though. In early November, he sent two communications to the San Francisco Chronicle, consisting of a greeting card, "This is the Zodiac speaking," another cryptogram, a 7-page letter, and a hand-drawn diagram of a bomb designed to destroy a school bus. To establish credibility, another swatch of Paul Stein's bloody shirt was enclosed in one envelope, although by now the Zodiac's handwriting, along with his odd habit of using more postage than required, were recognizable. The extra postage was simply practical. He could just pop the envelopes into a mailbox somewhere without having to come in contact with a human who could later identify him, and he knew for sure his mail would be delivered. We would later see the Unabomber employ this same technique. Although much attention was paid to the drawing and references to the Zodiac's bomb, I think other aspects of these communications, particularly the 7-page letter, are more significant. Consider the following. "I have grown rather angry with the police for their telling lies about me. So I shall change the way, the collecting of slaves. I shall no longer announce to anyone when I commit my murders. They shall look like routine robberies, killings of anger, plus a few fake accidents, etc." In numerous subsequent writings, the Zodiac would make reference to his new and improved body count. And after each of these, police would reevaluate unsolved murders in their jurisdictions, looking for potentially linked cases. In the early 1980s, some thought that the Zodiac and the Trailside Killer were one and the same. The conviction of David Carpenter in 1988 for those murders disproved this theory, as he was serving time for other crimes when several of the Zodiac killings occurred. Depending on whom you ask, though, today there are upwards of 50 possible victims of the Zodiac. In a sense, it's the opposite of linkage blindness, and we run into it with every large-scale unsolved serial case. To this day, people are still adding to the tally attributed to Seattle's Green River Killer, even though the first of those serial murders occurred in January of 1982. Indeed, one of the reasons the Zodiac's crimes continue to haunt us is that he captured the imagination of psychopaths as well as law-abiding citizens, making him a favorite for copycat criminals not only in the Bay Area, but even years later in New York City and Tokyo. For reasons too complex to get into here, police knew fairly quickly these cases were not the work of the Zodiac. What the Zodiac had effectively done was create the illusion he was still active, whether he truly was killing people or not. As long as he wrote to claim credit, the lore surrounding him would continue. He blamed the police and their lies for putting him in the position of having to keep his specific crimes secret, thus creating a face-saving scenario for himself. If he never kills again, people will still wonder. And if he does, he protects himself by not providing details that might lead police to his identity. Indeed, after this, he sent no more pieces of future victims' shirts, and no more detailed descriptions of crimes such as in the Jensen Faraday and Farron Majot attacks. One of the greatest mysteries of the Zodiac murders is why he stopped. Where did he go? We've discussed in Chapter 1 how serial killers just don't move down south and retire. Since the Zodiac kept writing for years after Stein's murder, we know he wasn't dead or presumably incarcerated. Perhaps he got sick or suffered some physical degeneration that made it impossible for him to carry out more crimes, but I think he just plain got scared. You run into a couple of policemen minutes after you've killed a man and you're covered in blood, the adrenaline still pumping. That's not something you get over too quickly. He'd shown in his crimes, communications, and ability to evade identification and capture that he was a sharp guy. He saw the writing on the wall. Offenders like this don't go down easy. To lose the high of being the lead story on the news for years, on and off, of having so many people fear you, to surrender all power and control and go to prison, that's when I advise a round-the-clock suicide watch, just as I did with the Unabomber, Theodore Kaczynski. At the same time, I think the Zodiac resented being in what he considered a position of weakness. He couldn't admit the fear. That would have made him feel even more inadequate than he already was. So instead, he lashed out in page after page. And he didn't only sound angry. He had to overcompensate by providing lots of details that showed his superior intelligence. The police shall never catch me, because I have been too clever for them. 1. I look like the description passed out, only when I do my thing, the rest of the time, I look entirely different. 2. As of yet, I have left no fingerprints behind me, contrary to what the police say. I wear transparent fingertip guards. All it is 2 coats of airplane cement coated on my fingertips, quite unnoticeable and very effective. If you wonder why I was wiping the cab down, I was leaving fake clues for the police to run all over town with. I enjoy needling the blue pigs. Hey, blue pig, I was in the park. You were using fire trucks to mask the sound of your cruising prowl cars. P.S. 2 cops pulled a goof about 3 minutes after I left the cab. I was walking down the hill to the park when this cop car pulled up, and one of them called me over and asked if I saw anyone acting suspicious. And I said, yes, there was this man who was running by waving a gun, and the cops peeled rubber and went around the corner as I directed them, and I disappeared into the park. Hey, pig, doesn't it rile you up to have your nose rubbed in your boo-boos? As the son of Sam, David Berkowitz also wrote long letters to the police, and by the end we could see his degeneration pretty clearly, too. In December, the Zodiac sent another letter with another piece of Paul Stein's shirt, this time to Melvin Belli. The message came in a Christmas card, and its tone was strikingly different from that of the last diatribe. He began by wishing Melvin a Happy Christmas, then moved on to ask for help and expressed some insecurity. Dear Melvin, this is the Zodiac speaking. I wish you a happy Christmas. The one thing I ask of you is this. Please help me. I cannot reach out for help because of this thing in me won't let me. The Zodiac warned that without help, he might take his 9th plus possibly 10th victim, implying there had been more murders since Paul Stein's, although the killer provided no details. Then he stressed, "Please help me. I am drowning." And, "Please help me. I cannot remain in control for much longer." Now, Belli put a positive spin on this letter, publicly stating that he saw it as indicating that the Zodiac, realizing he would soon be caught, was getting ready to turn himself in and wanted the attorney to help him avoid the gas chamber. Belli even said someone claiming to be the Zodiac had called his home when he wasn't there and had had such a good conversation with the housekeeper that he expected to come home one day and find the two of them having a chat. Years later, a vastly different interpretation was offered by my late esteemed colleague and valued friend, Dr. Murray Mirone. It was Murray's opinion that in this letter the Zodiac revealed his depression. Murray felt that waves of depression would pass over the subject, and that it was not entirely unlikely that in one of these virulent depressions, such individuals could commit suicide. I would agree that the Zodiac might eventually commit suicide, but I also believe that, even in a depressed state, the Zodiac wrote letters with the goal of manipulating, dominating, and controlling their recipients and the larger audience he knew they would reach. So while this unsub likely did feel more alone and alienated from society around Christmas time, I believe this letter was a play for sympathy, one emotion the Zodiac hadn't yet tried to get from the public. To confirm this, I would note that despite Belli's assurances that he would protect the Zodiac from the gas chamber and do all he could to help him, the killer never contacted him again. As I suggested earlier, one problem you confront when doing an analysis of this type of offender is there are so many potential Zodiac cases out there. Because we're dealing with a subject who at least predominantly killed strangers, who changed jurisdictions, who used different murder weapons and different MOs with different crimes, you can spend a lot of time getting hung up on cases that might not even be part of the picture. At the same time, you don't want to be guilty of linkage blindness. Linkage blindness. I've culled through a lot of unsolved crimes that may have been related to the Zodiac's series, and so far in this chapter I've limited our discussion to cases for which the killer claimed responsibility and offered some details or material evidence to substantiate his claim. We will now look at a case that illustrates how difficult it can be to rule an unsolved crime in or out of this series. Kathleen Johns, 23 years of age and 7 months pregnant, had about 400 miles to cover as she left her home in San Bernardino, California, headed for Petaluma. It was Sunday, March 22, 1970, and Johns was taking her 10-month-old daughter to visit her grandmother, Kathleen's mother, who was sick. Because of the length of the trip and the age of her baby, she planned to make most of the drive at night. She left in the late afternoon. Around midnight on Highway 132, Johns noticed a car behind her, blinking its lights and honking its horn at her. The driver pulled up alongside her car and yelled that one of her back tires was loose. They pulled over, and a clean-shaven, neat young man around 30 offered to tighten things up for her. She thanked him and stayed in the car while he ostensibly went back to fix it. When he was done, and she tried to drive off, the tire fell off altogether. The young man returned to the side of the road and offered this time to take her to a nearby service station, which she could see up ahead of them. She and her baby got into his car as the man went to turn off her headlights and retrieve her car keys for her. His kind acts stopped there, however, as he drove right by the gas station. They drove around for hours, with the man repeating to Johns that he would kill her and her baby. Finally, when he made a turn, she jumped out with her daughter and hid in a ditch. He tried to pursue her, but luckily for her, a truck happened on the scene and stopped, scaring the abductor off. What makes many people think that Kathleen Johns and her children narrowly escaped becoming Zodiac victims is that her description of her abductor so closely resembles those of earlier cases. While she was being driven around, she put all her concentration into noticing details. She told police her abductor was a bit shorter than her, 5 feet 9, and weighed about 170 pounds. He wore thick-rimmed glasses held in place with an elastic band around his head. He wore well-polished black shoes, black bell-bottoms, a white shirt, and a dark nylon jacket. The shoes, coupled with his crew-cut brown hair, gave her the idea he was in the military. Then, while giving her statement to police, she looked up and happened to see the composite sketch of the Zodiac circulated after Paul Stein's murder. She identified her abductor as the man in the drawing. The crime also took place on a weekend, like the others, and in a different jurisdiction, both aspects of Zodiac crimes. It is consistent with the overall presentation of the Zodiac as an organized offender, particularly since Kathleen Johns' car was later found moved from where it had been left, and completely burned out, so as to eliminate any evidence that might have been left behind. It is also consistent with criminal progression and escalation that the Zodiac might want to experiment with spending more time with his victim. And he had announced his intention to kill Brian Hartnell and Cecilia Shepherd after conversing with them for a while. This is a perfect example of a crime that may or may not be linked to the Zodiac. In late April of 1970, the Zodiac pulled out all the literary stops, sending a letter to the editor of the San Francisco Chronicle that included a teaser, "My name is," followed by 13 symbols or characters. News that he'd killed 10 people at that point, though the police couldn't identify any after Stein, an explanation of why he had not utilized his bus bomb, it had been damaged by recent rains, a schematic of a new bomb, and to top it all off, a dig at the police. The letter was signed with the crossed circle symbol and the number 10 alongside the initials SFPD and the number 0 written as a score. As though to stress his importance and accomplishments far above those of law enforcement, he sent another communication just over a week later. In a humorous greeting card, he threatened again to bomb a school bus unless the police released details from his last letter and bomb diagram. He also suggested people start wearing nice Zodiac button, like Black Power, Melvin Eats Blubber, etc. It would cheer me up considerably if I saw a lot of people wearing my button. We've seen this shift in moods before. The Zodiac obviously wrote his latest missive while he was in one of his buoyant emotional periods. It no doubt fueled his needed sense of self-importance when the chief of police in San Francisco went before the press to inform the public of the Zodiac's latest bomb threat. But the diagram was not printed in the newspaper, and no one started wearing Zodiac buttons. The summer of 1970 was a frustrating one for the Zodiac, if his letters are any indication of his emotional state. He wrote prolifically, sending 3 letters to the Chronicle in just a month, and one of these letters was the longest and arguably the most creative he'd sent thus far. At the end of June, he mailed a brief letter expressing his anger at the people of San Fran Bay Area. "They have not complied with my wishes for them to wear any nice," Zodiac symbol, "buttons." He noted that although he'd warned he'd retaliate for noncompliance by annihilating a full school bus, school was out for summer vacation, "so I punished them in another way. I shot a man sitting in a parked car with a .38. He drew another score, this time giving himself 12 victims, SFPD still 0. With the letter, he included a Phillips 66 road map of the area around Mount Diablo across the bay from San Francisco, and a 2-line cryptogram, which he asserted should be used in tandem to identify where he'd planted a bomb. The letter said authorities had until the fall to dig it up. As for his claim that he'd killed a man, while a police officer had been killed with a .38, there was a suspect in that case, and investigators found no evidence to suggest another Zodiac murder. The next letter began, "This is the Zodiac speaking. I am rather unhappy because you people will not wear some nice," Zodiac symbol, "buttons." He then brings up, "The woman and her baby that I gave a rather interesting ride for a couple hours one evening a few months back that ended in my burning her car." Since Kathleen Johns' abduction received only scant local press at the time, many interpreted this reference as proof that her abductor was, in fact, the Zodiac. Just 2 days later, the next letter was received. It continued the tone of anger and frustration in the other two, and upped the total of Zodiac victims to 13. It obviously greatly disturbed him that no one was wearing Zodiac buttons, and he wanted to let people know they would pay for this slight. "I shall, on top of everything else, torture all 13 of my slaves that I have waiting for me in paradise. Some I shall tie over ant hills and watch them scream and twitch and squirm. Others shall have pine splinters driven under their nails and then burned." And so on. The Zodiac then really revved up his creative talents, quoting from Gilbert and Sullivan's The Mikado and rewriting the lyrics. "As someday it may happen that a victim must be found, I've got a little list, I've got a little list of society offenders who might well be underground, who would never be missed, who would never be missed. There is a pest dulinchual nuisances who write for autographs, all people who have flabby hands and irritating laughs." It went on and on with examples of people he'd like to see done away with, quite incoherent in spots. But it's revealing of the Zodiac's nature. Line after line cited examples of people who, none of them, be missed, when it was actually he who would not be missed. But this is a cross-section of society, a petty, detailed list of all the kinds of people whom he perceived as having scorned him. Most of us register a slight, deal with it or brush it off, and move on. But not the Zodiac. In his mind, he was ever cataloging how society had wronged him. This letter was his opportunity to give some of that back. At the same time, he hoped he was impressing us with his talent. Of course, his verse doesn't scan properly, his spelling is miserable, and the sections that do make sense are not even clever. At least the overall metaphor works on some level, as the aria he embellishes is sung by the Lord High Executioner, which is doubtless a position he'd have liked to hold officially. One more point needs to be made about this letter. A postscript reads, "P.S. The Mount Diablo Code concerns radians and hash mark inches along the radians." Without getting too technical here, not that I could on this subject, a radian is a mathematical term representing an angle of measure. One school of interpretation views the Zodiac crime scenes in relation to each other in time and space through mathematical analysis. As an example, the theory holds that Paul Stein's murder occurred one block farther than he'd written on his log sheet because the killer needed him to be at a precise point on the map. That's why the Zodiac switched his victim choice from couples to a cab driver. Whom else could he get to a precise set of map coordinates so easily? Of course, one could argue that the killer's new base of operations was San Francisco, and he needed a murder site that would afford him an easy getaway, so being familiar with the Presidio and its environs, he figured that was the way to go. However you choose to look at it, the radian reference holds some meaning in that it is not something most citizens are aware of, and it, along with the Gilbert and Sullivan ripoff, shows an offender who comes off as both well-educated and illiterate, a fascinating combination, which may help account for his occasional lapses into disorganization at the crime scenes, having the presence of mind to wipe off Paul Stein's cab, yet leaving fingerprints anyway, for example. His exposure is wider than his expertise is deep, if you will. This is likely why one avenue of investigation pursued by Toski and Armstrong in San Francisco came up empty. They investigated players with the Lamplighters, the city's Gilbert and Sullivan Company. Interestingly, a run of the Mikado opened at Presentation Theater 1 week after Paul Stein was shot, just a dozen or so blocks from the murder site. I would suggest that, while this guy was reasonably sharp, he did not have the personality of a performer. You'd be looking for someone behind the scenes, someone with technical expertise. But this interest would stand out to the few who knew him well, since it would seem in direct contrast with his knack for such things as numbers and codes. A letter to the press. That fall, there was a development that completely shook up the investigation. First, the Zodiac sent a Halloween card and a personal threat that proclaimed, You are doomed, to Paul Avery, the lead investigative reporter on the case at the Chronicle. Avery began carrying a gun, and he and fellow reporters started wearing buttons reading, I am not Paul Avery. The card got a lot of press from the Chronicle and elsewhere, and Avery received a bunch of tips, including one from Southern California. One letter, not from the Zodiac, encouraged Avery to check into whether the Zodiac had committed his first crime in Riverside, California. It was the unsolved murder of a young girl around Halloween. The anonymous tipster claimed he'd brought the possible connection to police, but had been brushed off. If you've been reading closely, you're probably returning to the murder of Sherry Jo Bates, the first case presented in this chapter. Recall the detailed letter which, in retrospect, seems so familiar to the Zodiac's painstaking descriptions of the Jensen Faraday and Farron Majot crimes. Remember how the letters to Joseph Bates, the police, and the press were signed with the letter Z? And I didn't even mention that the envelopes all contained extra postage, just like later Zodiac letters. I've always said that in evaluating a series of crimes, you need to focus on the first one because that will show you where the inexperienced offender is comfortable. That crime is close to where he lives or works, and his behavior in the commission of that crime is most natural and revealing because he hasn't yet perfected his techniques. What would the Bates unsub have learned from that crime? First, that a petite woman can still be hard to control. The next few blitz-style gun attacks eliminated that problem. Then, he really didn't get the credit he likely felt he deserved for such a crafty crime. After he'd gone to all the trouble to set the trap and kill his victim and then got away with it, nobody paid attention to the letters he sent directly to police, the victim's father, and the press at the 6-month anniversary of the crime. So he learned that if he wanted credit in the future, he had to supply the details or tangible evidence. But if Bates was his, and this killer liked attention so much, why wouldn't he go for it once his credibility as the Zodiac had been established? For one, given his inferiority-superiority complex and his love-hate relationship with the police, I think he got off on what he saw as the ultimate, I know something you don't know. He must have relished every time he read the other murders referred to as the Zodiac's first. Also, if it was truly his first murder, it's possible he'd spent time around Bates and the library before. I'm not saying he necessarily knew her, but he'd seen her, because she and he had the same base of operations. He may have been afraid to let the investigation get too close to home, fearing that, if nothing else, someone might draw a connection with the dates of each change in venue. I believe the Bates killing is at least one more in the series, if not the first Zodiac crime. And this belief is backed up by the findings of experts, such as California Bureau of Criminal Identification and Investigation handwriting expert Sherwood Morrill, who has connected the writings in the Bates Had to Die messages and on the desktop with the later work of the Zodiac. I also think it's more than a coincidence that after this link was made, communication with the killer dropped off. He sent a letter to the Los Angeles Times in March of 1971, the first time he'd ever contacted that publication. In it, he boasted again that the blue meanies would never catch him, and observed that the longer they fiddle and fart around, the more slaves I will collect for my afterlife. He did acknowledge the Bates murder as one of his doing, but scorned police, saying, "They are only finding the easy ones. There are a hell of a lot more down there." And this time, his score was 17+, while the SFPD stagnated at 0. Just about a week later, Paul Averly received a postcard featuring an advertisement for a condominium development in Lake Tahoe, the crossed circle Zodiac symbol, and choice phrases cut out of newspapers. There was no obvious message, so investigators tried to interpret the meaning of the card, looking into unsolved crimes there to see if this was a veiled reference to another murder. Nothing could conclusively be linked to the Zodiac. The best satirical comedy. And nothing was heard from the killer for nearly 3 years. Then at the end of January 1974, another letter came into the San Francisco Chronicle. In familiar handwriting, the letter read, "I saw and think The Exorcist was the best satirical comedy that I have ever seen. Followed up with more misspelled references to the Mikado. By now, he'd raised his victim count to 37. The next two letters came into the Chronicle in May and July of that year. The May letter was full of anger, criticizing the paper for running ads for the movie Badlands, based on the Charles Starkweather, Carol Ann Fugate murder spree of the 1950s, which the Zodiac apparently found too violent for his refined tastes. The July letter was similarly critical of the newspaper's content, this time singling out a specific columnist. The man was spooked enough to leave the paper for a time. Then, after a gap of nearly 4 years, the last verified Zodiac letter was received in April of 1978. It read simply, "Dear Editor, this is the Zodiac speaking. I am back with you. Tell Herb Kane I am here. I have always been here. That city pig Toski is good, but I am," crossed out letters, "smarter and better. He will get tired, then leave me alone. I am waiting for a good movie about me. Who will play me? I am now in control of all things. Yours truly." Where the signature would have appeared, there was yet another score. Zodiac, guess, SFPD, 0. I think the gaps of years between letters is significant. I wonder if our guy was in jail on some minor charge, frustrated but at the same time gloating that the criminal justice system had no idea whom they were holding. It's also possible that his silences coincided with trips out of the area, new military assignments if he'd been able to stay in, perhaps, or an illness. I also think it's significant that, consciously or not, in this last letter he touches on all the major themes and motives operative in his life. He affirms his existence, "I am here," and his worth, superiority, "I am smarter."